All right, so just do again brief review as always, just to get us kind of caught up to speed here of where we've been in our Old Testament survey two, as we kind of started in Joshua and we're going to wrap up in 1 Samuel. But just again, what's been going on? So Joshua started, they're entering the land. God is establishing Israel in the land. He's putting them there for a purpose to make an international impact, to essentially put God's agenda on display to the world around him, which that agenda is that God really does own everything, that everything is his and therefore should point back to him and his glory. But then you guys know the issue. What was Israel's issue? They were what? Starts with S, ends in inful.
Sinful.
Sinful. Yeah, they're sinful. All right. They're sinful. And we saw that fleshed out more in the book of Judges, where they failed on the physical level to fully conquer the land as they'd been instructed in Joshua, as well as the spiritual level that they were going after other gods. They were rejecting the Lord. And really, that disobedience was tied into that failure to conquer land. If you remember that, their success was not dictated by military strategy or strength, but by obedience. And so that's what we saw in Judges, that they failed in this regard. But even despite their failure, God preserves the nation so that they would ultimately get a king. And so we've been heading that direction. And even in the book of Ruth, we saw God's faithfulness to preserve a faithful remnant who really did want to follow him. And we saw specifically, like through the lives of Boaz and Ruth, that God was moving his plan forward and moving Israel to a king. And really, not just any king, but to the right king, which, if you remember in Ruth, who's it kind of end with? Who's it all pointing to?
Christ.
Eventually Christ, but yeah, David, right? Yeah. So, yeah, yes. Yeah, so ultimately, like in the nearer context, it ends with that genealogy that culminates in David, that it's going to be pointing to him. But we did also connect that genealogy at the end with the genealogies of Genesis, which link to Genesis 3:15, which is to the seed, which would be Christ eventually. So it does culminate in that, but we're heading in the near term to David is kind of what we're seeing. And so really, Ruth is showing the plan is still on track. We're moving forward. And then we got into the book of 1 Samuel. And so, and that's where we're going to be today and finish up next week. And so, again, the theme of 1 Samuel is the God who prepares his king. And really, we again start to see this focus on kings that begins in 1 Samuel and finishes in 2 Kings. So there's this emphasis on kings during these books. But if you remember, we've been dealing with more than just kings themselves, but also this, what we call like a theology of kingship, where God is unpacking in these books of what does it mean to be a king? What should a king be like? What should they not be like? What certain things should surround a king? All of that stuff is what we're seeing, and we're going to see even more of that today as we get into 1 Samuel. So then last week, we got into 1 Samuel with primarily the first part here, which is this preparation for the monarchy, where really the main point was that God is beginning this kind of final transition from like the time of the judges and all that to the kings. And as he does this transition, he is really reinforcing the foundation of this kingship, the foundation of this theology of kingship, which is that it's all about like the capital K king, okay, which is God. And that's what these first seven chapters were establishing, is that God is the true king. This is what it's all about, okay? And we saw that declared not only to Israel, but even to like the nations. If you remember with the ark getting moved around within the Philistines, and how even in that, Israel does nothing in that regard. It's all God, and the Philistines are understanding this is the true God, this is the true king. And so it's getting put on bright display, not only to Israel, but to the nations. And really, he's establishing that, yes, God is the true king, and Israel, you are to be a theocracy, essentially. And we even saw God fighting battles on their behalf, like in chapter 7, we saw that. But then as we kind of transition to the institution of the monarchy, we saw this kind of pivotal chapter in chapter 8 where Israel ends up demanding a king. And so despite all that they had witnessed with God and working on their behalf, that God is the king, they demanded a king. And you remember we talked about last time, their desire to have a king wasn't necessarily wrong, because again, God's plan has been all along, like we're heading towards a king. Even Judges was showing you like you need a king and all that. And so it's all part of the plan. But the issue was they wanted a certain kind of king. And really they wanted a king of their own choosing. That was their issue. Okay, so not that they wanted a king, but they wanted a king of their own choosing, and just like all the other nations. That was really their standard. And so even though Israel was supposed to be like a theocracy and God was their king, they wanted to change the whole system. They don't want a theocracy. They don't even want a theocratic monarchy. They just want a monarchy like the rest of the nations. And so essentially what they are saying to God is, give us a human king and you don't have to be our king anymore. That's what's going on. And so you can understand then why God tells Samuel, like, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected me from being king over them. Okay, that's the big deal of this. And if you remember, because this is going to tie in today as well, do you remember what they primarily wanted a king for in chapter 8? What was their main reason of why do they want a king? To do some for them.
To be like the other nations?
Yeah, to be like the nations, true. But then like a specific function.
Fight their battles.
Yeah, to fight their battles. To like, we want someone who can lead us out in battle, fight our battles. Which again, ironically, is like, well, that's exactly what God was doing, right? Like, and so they're just totally ignoring that. But they want that. That's their whole focus. But if you also remember what we talked about, was that really the main role of a king? Based on like God's instructions, like in Deuteronomy 17 that we looked at before, was that really the main goal of a king, was to be like a fighter of their battles? I don't know. No, it was actually like in Deuteronomy 17 talks, one of the main functions of the king was they were supposed to write a copy of the law. And so they were really supposed to be like an enforcer of the law. They were supposed to uphold the law. That was their primary purpose as a king. And so, yes, that would include fighting some battles, but that's not the main purpose. The main purpose was to enforce the law, uphold the law for the people. And so, again, we're going to see like why that's significant today. Okay. But then chapter 8 kind of ended with God giving the people a king, allowing them to have a king. And really, it's kind of, again, that be careful what you wish for. And God is going to give them the perfect king for like what they wanted, which, as you can imagine, is probably not the right king. And that initial king is who? You guys remember? Saul, right? Saul. And so we talked about the second part of the book. This whole focus on Saul is going to kind of develop our theology of kingship by telling you what a king shouldn't be in order to teach you what a king should be. Okay, like Saul is that bad example for us to learn from. Okay, that's what's going on here. All right, so that takes us into where we're starting today. So chapter 9, Saul chosen as king. And so in this chapter, we get to see this introduction to Saul. And what do we know about him? What do we know about Saul? What are some things?
Handsome.
Yeah, he was handsome. And not only just handsome, what's it say? There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. He was like the most handsome guy. Okay, so yeah, handsome Saul. Okay, what else do we know?
He was tall.
So not only the most handsome guy, he was like the tallest guy. So he's like the supermodel of Israel. And like, he looks awesome. He's going to be great. Okay. What else do we kind of know about him? What's his background? What tribe is he from?
Benjamin.
Yeah. So keep that in mind as well. But yeah, so the main things that the Bible focuses on here is kind of the external. He's handsome, he's tall. And if you remember before, when people's characteristics are normally named, that's going to come into play at some point. And what you also see, this theme kind of with people in leadership, or especially kings, when their physical external characteristics are focused on, that normally is going to be an indication that they're going to fail, okay? Because you can think of examples like, do you guys remember David's son, Absalom? Do you remember what's known about him by chance? Put your Bible trivia on. The main physical characteristic of him. I feel like once I say, you'll be like, oh, yeah. But he had nice hair. You guys remember? That was kind of the thing. It was luscious locks of hair, which ends up what? Coming back to kind of bite him. His hair gets caught in a tree and then leads to his death, right? Like, so it's kind of bad. And then you even see David is described as well, like as being a handsome man and all this stuff. And as we'll see in 2 Samuel, once we get there, that was going to tie into some of his failures as well. And so there's this theme kind of here. And so when the Bible points out these things, it's normally kind of like a trigger for us of, okay, like something's going to happen with this, or this person might, when you're focusing on the external, that's normally not good. Okay. So that's what's going on here. And so, and so really, again, like that point is when you base your opinions on someone from like the outside, the exterior, then you know that that's not going to be God's ultimate king. That's what's going on. And so that's why God will see, he looks for a man after his own heart. That's what he tells Samuel. And so the heart is crucial. And that's what's going to define a true king of Israel. So again, this theology of kingship, you're going to begin to see it's not based on the externals, it's based on the heart. All right, let's see. And so kind of back to this. So you have this handsome guy, Saul. He comes on scene and he's looking for his father's donkeys who has wandered off. And so he and his servant go looking for them. And in the process, they meet Samuel. So they meet the prophet Samuel. And the Lord tells Samuel that Saul is the guy that's going to be king over his people. And so then in chapter 10, you have Samuel anointing Saul to be king. And so this comes to a surprise to Saul, all that. And then the last part of chapter 10, you have the public proclamation of Saul as king over Israel. And so Samuel gathers all the tribes at Mizpah, and Saul is proclaimed to be king. And do you guys remember what happens when they like proclaim to be king? What kind of happens? Do you remember? Yeah, they like can't find him. Okay. Like, and I just love like picturing this as a scene where you just think of Samuel is doing this whole introduction, like, and here's your king, Saul. And it's like, it just picture a movie scene where they pan to like the scene and no one's there. Where is he? Right? Where is he? And they're, so they look for him. And do you guys remember where he is? Where he's hiding? Yeah, like in the people's baggage and luggage, right? He's just kind of like, this is just kind of, again, you just picture, it's just funny, like this tall guy trying to like hide in the luggage. I don't know what he's doing. Yeah. So is that like a great start for your king? Probably not. Okay. But does Israel really care? No, because as soon as they see him, what? They're like, that's the guy. He's super handsome. He's tall. He's awesome. He's exactly the kind of king they would want. Exactly the kind of king that they would want. But as we've seen, the nation of Israel through this time, through like the end of Joshua, Judges, all that, right, is the nation of Israel, do you think they'd actually want like the right king? No. And so what they would think is the right king is probably not. And so in their eyes, Saul is awesome. He looks great. Looks like the, again, probably like the kings of any other nations. That's really what they wanted. And so that's what they get. And again, they should have realized that he was not the right king, because just even on a foundational level, we mentioned what tribe was Saul from? Benjamin. And if you remember our study of the Old Testament up to this point, what was supposed to be kind of the kingly line? What was the line that the kings were supposed to come from? What tribe? Judah. And so, again, you see clearly that should have been a dead giveaway that this isn't the right guy. But, again, do they care? No. They just look at the external. They just look at, he looks great. He looks awesome. We got a good king. Here we go. All right. And so, in chapter 11, in the midst of Saul being chosen as king, I should point out, like in chapter 10, like you see these mentionings that Samuel tells Saul that God is going to use you to deliver the nation of Israel from the enemies around you and everything. And real quick, I'll just kind of describe. Bring that a little closer. kind of the role of the three main kings of the united monarchy. So before like the nation splits, you have the three kings of Saul, and then after him you have David, and then after him you have David's son Solomon. Okay, and so kind of the three functions, like militarily speaking, so not like total, but militarily speaking, you can think of them functioning in this way. So Saul is primarily defense. Saul is primarily defense. He is going to be essentially keeping the door cracked open to allow like David to come and all that. So his goal is pretty much to just keep Israel alive and survive kind of the onslaught of people. And then once you come to David, his primary goal is offense, where he's going to kind of expand the border. He's going to push out a little bit. So Saul keeps the door kind of cracked open, and David kind of opens the door further. And then you have Solomon, whose kind of primary goal is dominion. Okay, dominion, where essentially he just gets this full control over that region, and he really is reigning and has dominion over that area. Okay, so that's kind of just if you think in this big picture of how these three kings are functioning. So really what you're going to see with Saul is God is going to use him to kind of keep Israel just alive and kind of just keep his enemies at bay for the moment, but as they keep attacking. And so we begin to see some of that unfold in chapter 11, where you see the Ammonites come and kind of attack parts of Israel. And so specifically, they come and besiege Jabesh-Gilead. And the response to Jabesh-Gilead is interesting because they try to make a treaty with the Ammonites. So like, hey, please don't hurt us. Let's make a treaty. Which, is that a good thing? No. If you remember, they weren't supposed to be making treaties with the people of the nations there. They were supposed to be conquering the land. And so, but they tried to make this treaty. And it's especially even worse because what just happened? Like, they just got a king, and it's now like they're acting still like they don't have one. Where it's like, oh, we got a king, but let's make a treaty with this guy. Let's forget Saul or whatever. They're not even thinking of that. But they try to make this treaty, but the Ammonites, they kind of want something in return. They're understanding, we're going to destroy you. That's why you want this treaty. So do you know what they ask for them to do in return? Yeah, to gouge out all their right eyes. You're like, that's weird. And so the question is like, why? Yeah, it's like, why would they want that? Okay, why would they want, like, outside of being painful, that's obviously not like a good thing. There's kind of a purpose to this. And so specifically the men that they're wanting all the guys to gouge out their right eye. And it's because at that time, if you think about it, here's your little Jabesh-Gilead guy. Nice and happy. Most of the people back then were right-handed, right? That's why Ehud and Judges was so unique. He was left-handed. And so if you're fighting with your sword and stuff, they hold it in your right hand. Your nice sword there going on. Okay, he's ready for battle. But what else do they use? Your sword and shield. Okay? And so what they would normally do as you're protecting yourself, they had those bigger shields at that time. They would cover that part of your body. And so if you're looking at this guy, if you're defending yourself with your shield, you have your thing. What happens if you cut out that right eye? Can't see anything anymore, right? And so kind of this purpose, this was strategic to make the people of Jabesh-Gilead, to make that city essentially militarily incompetent. Like they couldn't fight anymore. And so that's why the Ammonites request this, was to essentially make it so like we know for a fact you're not going to fight back anymore. So this just decimates you. So you're no threat to us because you can't even attack anymore because you won't be able to see if you're trying to fight. And so you can see that's a very strategic, that's a very serious thing that they are requesting here. This isn't just, oh yeah, pluck at your eye because that's interesting, like that's cool. No, they do it for a purpose. And so obviously the people don't really want to do this. And there's kind of a funny interaction because they ask the Ammonites, like, well, can you give us a moment to like see if anyone will deliver us? And then if not, then okay, we'll do it. Which, I don't know, if you're the Ammonites, that's weird to say. Yeah, go ahead. go find some help. Okay? But they allow it, so they send out for help and everything, and eventually the news reaches Saul. And do you remember what Saul's doing as he, like, before, right before he hears of this? Do you happen to know?
He's in the field.
Yeah, he's farming. Right? He's farming. This dude just got anointed as king, declared as king, and he's just like, kind of like, well, I'm going to go back to my farm. Like, see you guys. Right? He's not ruling. He's not acting like this king. He's just out farming. And so again, not like maybe the best start here, but when he hears of this, it says like the Spirit of God rushed upon him, and that's where you start to see he acts, okay? And then he springs into action. And I should even point out, where have we heard mention of Jabesh-Gilead before? You guys remember what's significant about that city? No. Saw them somewhat recently in our study here. In the book of Judges, specifically.
Kill a bunch of people?
Yeah, yeah. They were the town that didn't go to the meeting where they made the vow. And so then the people determined, oh, no one was there and they made the vow, so let's go kill all their people and steal their women to give them to the Benjaminites. Right? That whole thing. Okay? So Saul being from the tribe of Benjamin, what's that make the people of Jabesh-Gilead? There is what? Not enemy. Related, right? They're related. They're family. Because remember, they wiped out all of the people of Jabesh-Gilead and gave all the women from Jabesh-Gilead to the Benjaminites. So then that repopulated the tribe. So this is his relatives. This is his family and everything. And so they have this connection there as well. And so Saul reacts to this news. He sends for all the tribes of Israel to come. And then notice verse 7 in chapter 11, because something significant kind of happens here. So he cuts up like the oxen, sends it, like, you need to come and all that. But notice the end of verse 7. It says, then the dread of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out as one man. Okay, they came out as one man. And remember what we said about the judges previously? One of the ways that they proved themselves not to be like the right leader was that they were never able to unify the nation. They were never able to unify the nation. And what you see here is the sign of a true leader or a king is that they can unite the nation. Okay? That even though he's not like the overall right king, but you start to see this glimpse into this confirmation of what defines a king as someone who can unite the nation. And that's what we see. They're coming as one man. This is not what they used to do under the judges. This is now unique with the kings. So they're able to function in that way, okay? So that's all affirmed here. And so they all gather and they deliver the people of Jabesh-Gilead and defeat the Ammonites, okay? And then chapter 11 wraps up, and through chapter 12, you have this kind of renewal of the kingdom at play here. It says that Samuel gathers all the people at Gilgal in order to renew the kingdom. And the question kind of is, well, why does he gather the people at Gilgal? Because recently he's been gathering them at Mizpah. And so why the change here all of a sudden? And again, I'm just putting you guys to the test all over the place. Do you guys remember where we've seen Gilgal mentioned before? What's significant about that place, that city? For 500 points. So Gilgal, that's where the Israelites set up camp when they first entered the Promised Land. Okay, when they crossed the Jordan to enter the Promised Land in Joshua for the conquest, they set up camp at Gilgal. And that is where, like, they circumcised the new generation, if you remember that. They circumcised the new generation as they entered the land. And so it kind of makes sense that they go back here, because they're almost like essentially going back to their roots, or almost like starting anew or starting fresh. And just as they showed their dedication to the Lord back in Joshua by circumcising the new generation, so too you have here Samuel calling the people to renew the kingdom, essentially encouraging them to be dedicated to following the Lord and not rebelling against him. And so it's almost just like, hey, let's kind of reset, start over. Here we go. Like, we're renewing where we are as a kingdom. is we want to be wholly dedicated to the Lord. Just like when we came into the land, the people were circumcised, all that to show this dedication to the Lord. And now we want to kind of reaffirm that. And so then you have chapter 12, this speech of Samuel where he's calling the people to follow the Lord. Don't rebel against him. And he tells them, like, if they do this, as well as like if their king does this, then all will go well with them. But if they rebel against the Lord, then the Lord will be against them. And so you see here, he's using this kind of covenant language we saw like back in Deuteronomy where you had the blessings and curses. There's blessings for obedience, curses for disobedience. And you have kind of the same thing happening here where he's encouraging them to follow the Lord, be dedicated to the Lord. As you start this kind of new era of a monarchy here in Israel, follow the Lord. And so despite all the evil like that they've done, despite the evil in demanding a king, if they will be faithful to serve the Lord and really honor him as the true king, like the capital K king, then it will go well for them. But if they don't, it says like they will be swept away, both them and their king. And so again, you have to understand, like that's the foundation. You have to honor the true king, the capital K king, okay? All right, and so everything up to this point seems to be starting okay with Saul. I mean, he doesn't always have like the first good impression, but he seems to be doing all right. But then in chapter 13 is where you start to see more of his flaws kind of start to come out and really how he starts to completely derail, and it just kind of gets worse and worse throughout the book. It just, doesn't get better. It's almost like the downward spiral of Judges, right, where it just keeps getting worse here. And we see that in chapter 13, we see Saul's failure to wait. And so in this chapter, it kind of starts out by talking about like Jonathan, his son, defeats actually a garrison of the Philistines. And this kind of leads to another skirmish thing. And so Saul gathers the people again at Gilgal. So they go back there again to get ready for this battle. But while they're there, apparently like Samuel had given Saul instruction to wait there 7 days for him, and he would come and offer offerings to the Lord before this battle, and so all that. And so Saul is there waiting, and the time kind of comes, and Samuel's not there, and Saul's seeing as the days go on, more of his army is scattering. They're getting scared, and they start leaving and going away, whereas the Philistines keep getting more and more people. And so Saul's getting a little nervous about all this. And so he decides to kind of take things into his own hands, and he goes to perform the sacrifices himself. Okay? And I don't know, it's just almost like this picture, right, of it's like a kid being caught in the act of disobeying their parents. Maybe you've caught your kid in some way, but doing what they're not supposed to be doing. And that's exactly what happens here, where as soon as he offers like the burnt offering, who shows up? Samuel. Oh, here I am. And again, Samuel arrives and he asks him, like, what have you done? Again, kind of like what you do with your kids. Like, what did you do? Not that you don't know. You obviously caught them. But same with Saul. And so he's like, what have you done? And Saul tries to make excuses, saying, hey, I was trying to wait all this stuff and I wanted to seek the Lord, whatever. But the reality is he disobeyed. The reality is he disobeyed. And as a result of this failure, Samuel declares to him that his kingdom will not continue. His kingdom will not continue, but it will be taken from him because he did not keep the Lord's commands. And then notice verse 14 of chapter 13 when it says this, but now your kingdom shall not continue. So we see that. But notice what he then says. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. And so we again see this element of what a true king will be is the one that is a man after God's own heart. That's what God is looking for. It's again not about the external. It's not about how impressive they look, all that, but it's the heart. And so that's what Samuel tells Saul. Like, you don't have a heart for like God in obedience. And so the kingdom will be removed from him. So his dynasty will not continue. And again, we would expect that because, again, he's not part of the right line. He's not part of the right tribe, all that stuff. But we see this unfolding here. And so after this, Saul and his army move from Gilgal to Gibeah and are ready to face off against the Philistines who are camped at Michmash. Okay. And so then we get into chapter 14, where we see Jonathan defeating the Philistines. This is that kind of cool thing where you see Jonathan as they're kind of waiting on these sides. You have Gibeah, where the Israelites are at, Michmash, where the Philistines are at, and Jonathan decides, well, I don't want to wait. I'm just going to go attack them. I'll bring my armor bearer, and we're just going to go. You're like, that doesn't seem very smart, right? Like, just these two guys going and everything. But look at verse 6. Look at verse 6. Look what he tells his armor bearer there at the end of verse 6. He says, it may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. And so even though on like an earthly sense, this is not the smartest strategy, but what do you see about Jonathan? He has faith in the Lord, actually. He has faith. And so you start to see this contrast between even Saul and Jonathan. You'll keep seeing this contrast. But remember, Saul, he kind of disobeyed in that last chapter because he was afraid. He's like, I'm losing too many guys. I'm losing too many men. Like, I got to make the sacrifice quick and do all this. Whereas Jonathan's like, it doesn't matter how many we have. As long as the Lord's on our side, he's going to work. And Jonathan understood. That's what we saw throughout Joshua. It was in Joshua where we saw that success was not determined by, again, military strategy, but by obedience, by faith in the Lord. And so Jonathan understood that. And so he understands how all that works. And so he goes and they attack and God is faithful. He gives them success. And even the Lord intervenes. There's like an earthquake thing happen. All that causes chaos and confusion in the camp of the Philistines. And eventually you have like Saul and the people realizing, oh, what's going on over there? That sounds crazy. And they realize, oh, Jonathan's gone and the armor bearer's gone. And well, let's go help him out. Let's go in this battle. And so the Lord grants them victory in all of that. Okay, but again, you see this contrast between Jonathan and Saul. Jonathan has faith in all this. And then in the next part of chapter 14, you see Saul's foolish vow. And so, once again, you have like a seemingly high note followed by a kind of low note here. And so as this battle kind of continues, they're pursuing the Philistines. Saul makes a vow. And from what we've seen in our survey of the Old Testament recently, does that ever work out well for people? No. We saw like Jephthah, that didn't work out well. And we saw that, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on who else did that too. Oh, in Judges, right? When they made the vow of, we're not going to let any of our wives marry, like daughters marry the Benjaminites, and that whole led to a bunch of issues, okay? And so these vows are not going well. And so what's happening as they're pursuing the Philistines, they're in the midst of this battle, all that, you can imagine the people are tired, they're battling all these things, and you remember what kind of Saul does? He says, he lays a curse on anyone who eats any food until his evening and he is avenged of his enemies. That's what it says. Is that a smart vow to make? No. Like, your people are tired, they're weary, they're drained as they're trying to fight and battle all this, pursue people, and you say, hey, don't eat anything. Just stay weak, essentially. Not a good military strategy here. And so a terrible idea. But then as everything kind of progresses, we find someone eating some honey, and who eats the honey? Do you remember? Jonathan. Yeah, Jonathan, Saul's son. And he didn't hear the vow, okay? He didn't hear it, which is why he ate. But then when he was told the vow, even he understood. He's like, well, that's kind of dumb. Like, why do we do this, right? That's my paraphrase. It's not what he actually says. But essentially, it's like, that's dumb. We should have been eating like and enjoying the spoils of this victory and all this, right? And what you end up seeing is kind of the bad consequences of this foolish vow. Okay, so first off, you see like in verse 32, that once they finally defeat the Philistines, all that, the people are so hungry, they're so ravenous. What do they do in verse 32? It says, yeah, they ate the spoils of the animals, but they ate it with the blood. But you remember from the law, they were not supposed to eat animals with the blood. They were supposed to drain the blood, all that. But they're just so starving and hungry that they do this and they sin, okay? It ends up leading to them to sin in this temptation here, okay? So that's not good. And then to make matters worse, like at one point Saul kind of tries to communicate with the Lord, but the Lord doesn't respond. And so he realizes someone must have broken my vow. Like, who was it? And he's so upset that he declares boldly that this person will be put to death, even if it's his own son, which I'm sure when he said that, he's not actually thinking it was Jonathan. He's probably thinking, of course, it's not Jonathan. So yeah, even if it's my son, we'll put him to death. And what? They end up finding out it was who? Jonathan. Uh-oh. But again, when Saul hears this, what does he decide to do? He's going to go through with it? Going to kill his son? He actually is. Yeah. He actually decided. He's like, I'm going to kill my son. Which again, who does that remind you of? Of this person who made maybe not a smart vow with a bad consequence, and even though they probably shouldn't, they're going to go through with it. Who was that? Remember? Yeah, Jephthah. Jephthah with his daughter, where he made that vow, and then it's like, well, I guess my hands are tied. I'm going to kill my daughter, right? Like, that's not what it is. But Saul acting like a very similar way. But thankfully, the people kind of speak up, all the rest of the army and stuff, and they speak up and really deliver Jonathan out of Saul's hand. That's kind of what happens. And so they come to his defense and like, how could you put him to death? He just did like an amazing thing, victory for the Lord, all this stuff. And so they deliver him from Saul's hand. So he doesn't end up killing him. So at least he didn't do that. But again, you clearly see that Saul is not the right king. He's not the right king. All right. And then chapter 14 ends with just this kind of brief summary of confirming what we talked about with this, that Saul defends the land. So you see that, again, he's being, it says, like, attacked from on every side. Verse 47, when Saul had taken the kingship, he fought against all his enemies on every side. And so, again, you see this pressing from all directions from Israel. He's getting attacked by it from all sides. And again, Saul's function is to defend, to just keep the door open, keep the door cracked open, to pave the way for David, the right king, who's going to then advance and push, pressed back against all these enemies, okay? All right, and then we'll do chapter 15, and then we'll take a break here. But we see, once again, Saul's failure. Before, it's his failure to wait. Now it's his failure to follow. So again, to follow and really obey the Lord's command. And so what you're going to see here is his failure in this chapter, which will lead to not only his dynasty not continuing as we saw before, but then also that he will lose all right to even be king at that moment. And so in this chapter, this is the account where through Samuel, the Lord instructs Saul to go and defeat the Amalekites to fulfill the promise he made back in Exodus 17 when Israel was on their way out of the land of Egypt on the Exodus, on the way to the promised land. The Amalekites attacked them, and God made this declaration of, hey, like, I'm going to wipe them out for this, like, for the sin, I will repay that. And so this is kind of that fulfillment here. He's like, hey, Saul, this is what you need to do. We're fulfilling this promise that God made. You need to go devote them to destruction. And really the idea is they were supposed to devote everything to destruction. But does Saul do this? No. Like, we see he keeps the king Agag alive. And then they also keep a lot of the good things alive. It says they destroyed what was like worthless and stuff. So they're like, well, that's bad. Let's just destroy it anyways. But all the good stuff they kept and all that. And it seems like they destroyed maybe some of the Amalekites they encountered. But what's interesting is when you read this at first, you think, well, they only spared like the king. That's not too bad. But when you look at later, like scripture, like even in 1 Samuel, you're going to see the Amalekites come up again. And so they didn't really wipe out the Amalekites. So it wasn't just the king they spared. They spared more. They didn't really devote all of them to destruction. And so that's this issue, okay? And this also sets the stage when Saul fails to do this, not devoting them to destruction, this sets the stage for the book of Esther later on, okay? Because if you remember in the book of Esther, Haman is called an Agagite, or Agagite, I don't know how you say that. But he's an Amalekite. He's an Amalekite. And so he's trying to get revenge and finish the job his ancestor started. And so then you can start to understand why Haman really did not like Mordecai and the Jews so much. It wasn't just his own personal jealousy, which there's some of that, but it's because the ancestors. It's because of all that's going on, okay? And so this is even setting the stage for that. Like, Saul's failure here has ramifications later on, okay? So that's kind of the big deal of what's going on here. But back to here, they were called not to spare anything, but they end up sparing some things. And do you remember Saul's reason for this? Why they like spared some things? Yeah, he's like, well, we spared it because we wanted to like sacrifice these things to the Lord. And again, that sounds good on the surface. You're like, oh, that's kind of nice and noble. Well, on the one hand, it might have just been an excuse. We don't know for sure if that's really his motive. But then even if it was true, is that what the Lord wanted? No, that's not what the Lord wanted. He wanted obedience to what he commanded Saul. That's what he wanted. And that's what we then like have that famous line here, that to obey is better than sacrifice. That's what we see here. To obey is better than sacrifice. God doesn't just want the external actions. He wants a heart of obedience. That's what he wants. And so, because Saul has rejected the word of the Lord, what is the result? Verse 23 says, God has rejected him from being king. You rejected my word, I reject you from being king. And we can't miss the significance of that, because God has rejected him from being king. This means that he has no right to reign as king anymore, which means at this point, what should Saul have done? Yeah, go back to farming. Like, step down. Step down. You are not the king anymore. You have no right to reign. You have been rejected. You should step down. But what we see is Saul really reigns essentially another like 20 years. And you can even argue that he's essentially a usurper of the throne at this point. He's a usurper. That's how he's functioning. He should have made the way for the right king, which we're going to see is who? David. But he didn't. And so he's just functioning as this usurper of the throne for the rest of 1 Samuel. And so Saul is out, and the question is, well, then who is the right king? And that's what the rest of the book is going to turn to as we look at the rise of David in this last section. Okay, but we'll take a little break, and then we'll wrap up where we get to for today.